Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to this. It is the Rugby Dungeon. Thank you for listening, thank you for subscribing, and of course, if you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on Twitter. I'm at Jay Beardmore. This very podcast is at the Rugby Dungeon, and of course, there is Egg Chasers out every Sunday without fail. Me, Tim, and Phil at Rugby Podcast, also on Twitter. Today's guest is a little bit different. It is the award-winning journalist Matt Lawton. Now, for rugby fans, you may know that Matt was involved in the Laura Scott story, which originally broke the salary cap news for Saracens. Now, don't worry, we're not going to talk only about salary cap. That's been done to death. But I wanted to have a bit of a broader conversation with Matt about his career and also what it is to be an investigative journalist. Matt is currently working as the chief sports correspondent for The Times, but prior to that, he was the chief sports reporter for the Daily Mail. So I very much hope that you enjoy this and get a good insight as to what it is to be an investigative journalist. How are you, Matt?
Yeah, I'm fine, thank you. Yeah, good.
So I guess we'll just dive straight into it then. I mean, when you're looking at all of the news coverage from this last week on Saracens, how are you feeling about it? Because, of course, you were there right at the outset.
I was, yeah. It was. I did. I'm at the Times now. Have been since September, but prior to that, I was at the Daily Mail. And one of the things I did when I was there as chief sports reporter was I asked the head of sport there if we could create an investigations team, and the two journalists that joined me were Laura Lambert, now Laura Scott, who's at the BBC now, and Mike Keegan, who's still at the Mail. And the whole idea was to, you know, get our teeth into some pretty meaty subjects.
Yeah.
We did some interesting stuff, and the story that Laura brought in was about Saracens. And so, yeah, worked very closely with her on it. It's her story. But you know, offered support and a bit of guidance on it. And, you know, we did some work together on it. As I say, reiterate very much Laura's story and an incredible amount of work she put into it. I know better than anybody the amount of work she put into it. And, no, I'm very pleased for her. I'm very proud of what we did as a team. In that time that it's come to this.
Okay, so when a story like that comes across your desk, was your idea to form the unit to investigate, to find that story, or did the story come to you and then you thought, right, okay, now we'll form this investigations unit?
Oh, no, the investigations team was formed before that.
Yeah.
It's sort of what I'd been doing for a number of years at the Mail when I became chief sports reporter back in 2013. And I'd done some pretty meaty stories, Team Sky stories, pretty exciting stories, racism stories, Matthew Mackay sort of discrimination stories.
Yeah.
And you know, done stuff about Lance Armstrong early on, things like that. But what I was becoming aware of was that there were almost too many stories. And so the first thing that happened was I actually asked the head of sport to find me a young up-and-coming journalist who might want to come and work with me. Mm-hmm. And Lee Clayton is now the head of sport at, or rather not the head of sport, but head of Talk Sport. identified Laura. She was actually on the showbiz desk at the time, and that people might be dismissive of that, but actually what that did, because she joined the newspaper as a trainee, is that gave her a very good kind of basic news background. And so she came to work with me, this was early 2018, I think, off the top of my head. Yeah, early 2018. And so we did some stuff very early on. We did quite a big story about Derby County and kind of internal battles there. And then Laura worked with me on all the stuff I did on the political crisis at the PFA, Professional Football Association. She was very much involved in all of that. So the rugby story was, because what you do when you work in a team like that is you everyone tries to contribute, and the rugby story was the big fish that Laura caught and brought into the team.
What would be the red flag with that story which immediately set your antenna off?
Well, I can still remember her first mentioning it to me, and sources had said to her, there's something to look at here. Mm-hmm. This is what we believe has been happening. And my response to that is, get stuck in, go away and do the digging. And what she did, like, Laura's talent is, well, she has many talents, but one of her talents as a journalist is her sort of thoroughness and her, you know, the first story we ever did together, mm-hmm. she was still on, she was still actually on the showbiz desk. And I asked her to go to the High Court to get a load of legal documents about Derby County.
Yeah.
Because I was away at an England game in Amsterdam, and I knew Laura was in London, and I'd been alerted to the case files being at the High Court, and it was a case of, going along with the case number and getting the documents.
Wow.
And she was able to digest 120 pages of legal documents and get a basic framework together for the story. She's very talented in that respect. And the great piece of work, obviously you've got to have the contacts to be alerted to what's been going on at Saracens.
Yes.
But then it was a case, an incredibly, sort of almost like police work, where she literally had to go through every name in the squad and all the different directors and people attached to the club and do a forensic search of Company's House and Land Registry and all these different databases. And then it was almost like when you're watching TV and you've got murder cases and they've got all the pieces of string across the board. And that's what she was doing. And it was, by the time she came back, she had it. She had the story. It was all there. And then it was a case of doing what you have to do. Then you have to put it to the relevant people. And as I say, it was my role, and it was pretty minor, really, it was a brilliant story, and I very much hope she is recognised, accordingly for it. She should win every award going this year.
So, when you've got a story like Saracens One or Derby County or anything, I mean, these things are obviously highly confidential. They're between the players and the management, or if it's a Derby County thing, it's all...
They're not that confidential, because... They're not confidential because they were a matter of public record. They were there, the Company's House and on the Land Registry. Well, it was just knowing where to look. So, yeah. Anyway, go on. Sorry.
So how do you then get... Okay, so with the information that is available, how then do you start to add the meat on the bones to actually what the story is? How do you go about assessing the additional information and making sure you talk to the right people? And how do you get those people then to talk?
Well, that's what you're talking about here is the basics of journalism, really. That's about talking to people, building contacts. Mm-hmm. Without sounding arrogant about it, that's 27 years in journalism. You know what I mean? That's you get to know people. Your contacts, your web of contacts, grows over the years, and hopefully people talk to you. Some people see a value in speaking to journalists. Some people don't. But, as I say, if it wasn't for journalism, Saracens would still be getting away with it. Mm-hmm. If it wasn't for journalism, the Russians would still be cheating at doping. Mm-hmm. You know, that was all completely journalism. That was ARD, which is a dedicated doping division of there's a German broadcaster, and they happen to have a dedicated doping division. Mm-hmm. You know, that they in the wake of the I think in particular the telecom team doping scandal in cycling, and then all the stuff that came out in the 90s about, you know, when all the Stasi files, the German government commissioned a report into doping in East and West Germany, and they have a dedicated doping division. So when somebody decided to blow the whistle on what was going on with athletes being extorted for money to cover up their positive drug tests by the most powerful people in athletics,
yes,
the whistleblower went to ARD because they were the only dedicated doping journalists in the world, and fair play to them. You know, Hajo Seppelt, the journalist who broke that story, you know, again, you know, deserves enormous credit, you know. So, that, you know, that is how investigative journalism works. You know, you need someone to come to you with a story, you know.
Do you think it's significant that it took a journalist not from a rugby background, or sorry, not in sports at the time, plus yourself, who was working mainly in football, to actually dig into this story?
Do you know what I think it is? And again, this comes back to the investigations team. I wouldn't blame the rugby correspondents, because I was a football correspondent. Chief football writer at the Mail for 11 years. And actually, when you're on that hamster wheel, it's quite hard to break free and devote that kind of time to something.
Yes.
Because, you know, my week as a football correspondent used to be get a Saturday interview, mm-hmm. big read for the Saturday paper, probably be doing one or two matches midweek, doing a game every Sunday, trying to take Saturdays off. Sounds a bit odd as a sports journalist, but certainly when I was the football correspondent, the biggest game of the week was normally the 4 o'clock Sunday game.
Yeah.
So I would try to get some time in my family, would try and basically get everything done by Friday morning and then try and be off until Sunday afternoon. But, you know, you were just running from match to interview and in the meantime trying to get the odd news story. So I think rugby writers were aware of it.
Yep.
But that's why I do what I do and what I did at the Mail and what we set up, was because I could see more and more. The reason I asked the head of sport if people could come and work with me is because I do actually think that sports news, sports investigations, that really is where the battle, certainly among newspapers, is being fought these days. And indeed, people like the BBC, mm-hmm. who are very good at it as well. Yeah, you've got to give credit to people like Mark Daly for the Salazar investigation, Panorama stuff.
Yeah.
So at the BBC. So I think it's a really competitive area. And as I say, I did it on my own for sort of 4 or 5 years and then said, I need some help here because I'm getting told about stuff that I just haven't physically got time to go after. So I think the reason it ended up being the investigations team and Laura who nailed Saracens was because we have a role where we don't have to be in the paper every day. We can actually, you know, my bosses trust me to, if I'm not in the paper for 2 weeks, they know that I'm not playing golf. You know, I don't play golf actually anymore. But they know I'm not playing golf.
Yeah.
I'm working. But some stories take a long time to execute.
Yeah, and I guess with, I'd say, a lot of soft media, you know, podcasts like ourselves, or, you know, online outlets now, there really isn't the funding for a lot of these outlets to go and actually work on a story for 2 weeks.
No, and that's the other thing, because this is the other issue, and this is why, and it's what worries me, to be honest, for the future, is that, look, journalism, you know, has its bad apples, of course it does. And, you know, it's like any profession. Not everything is perfect, but you look at some of the journalism that's being done, and you go, if you're lucky enough to be nominated, you go to some of these awards nights, journalism awards nights, and you sit there and you see the stuff that people have done over the last year, and you sit there and you see, you know, for instance, people at the time, stories about, you know, the sort of paedophile rings in Rotherham, Oxfam abuse of, you know,
the Haiti stuff
of, you know, it, there's some brilliant journalism, and my worry, I guess, is that as people stop paying for journalism, stop buying newspapers, is that there won't actually be the resource to do it in the long term. I hope there is, and I think, you know, I would like to think that newspaper groups like News UK and Associated Daily Mail will still be successful enough businesses to be able to fund that kind of journalism, because it's brilliant, and it's the only way that whether it's politicians or people in sport or, you know, every part of our society and not just in the UK but beyond, it's the only way people are held to account half the time, because I think what we see really is that you can't rely on those who are supposed to regulate.
Yeah.
You know, it was years and years of journalism about FIFA before actually it was actually, you know, it was the American, you know, law enforcement services who got there in the end. But it was years and years of journalism that kept flagging up problems at FIFA, corruption at FIFA, you know, and likewise, you know, it was journalism that finally brought the Russians down with what they were doing with doping. And you know, someone's got to pay for that. And I just very much hope that people realise the importance of that and they do keep paying for it.
Now, you've just mentioned some really meaty subjects there, obviously, corruption in FIFA, corruption with the Russians. How do you, as a guy who covers lots of sports, how do you view the situation in rugby? Do you think it's well run? Do you think it's, you know, essentially very corrupt, or do you think it's, you know, actually compared to other sports, not too bad?
I've got to say, given how far over the salary cap they seem to be, you do have to wonder what the salary cap regulator was doing. You do have to wonder, you know, as I understand it, it's one person, to be fair to him,
yes,
whose job it was to regulate the salary cap. But it's, you know, I remember some of those conversations that I was party to with Laura, and people seemed completely oblivious to it. You know, we sat with a couple, some very senior people in rugby, very, very senior people in rugby, who were just appeared to be completely surprised that this was going on, you know, in terms of the, you know, the sort of arrangements that there were with players.
Yes.
So, yeah, clearly it's not, I would suggest, not fit for purpose in terms of regulating itself. The Premiership clearly wasn't regulating itself. You know, as I say, everyone is saying, well, we're not surprised, everyone knew it was going on. But no one was doing anything about it.
So just,
you know, Laura,
just,
you know, Laura was the one that exposed it.
Just
because
on,
everyone else was, you know, proving ineffective.
Just on the salary cap manager, have I got this right? Did Saracens declare the companies to the salary cap manager as and when they occurred?
That I don't know.
Because that is the message that Saracens have been putting out, that everyone was fully aware of these things, but being aware of them isn't necessarily the same as knowing exactly what they are.
Yeah, maybe they've. Well, look, I don't know the answer to that, because, sure, as I say, well, like, you know, we actually don't. You know, they're not even revealing the full report, are they? The Dyson report. So, you know, that would be helpful to everybody, wouldn't it? So no, I don't know the ins and outs of that, because the one thing Laura found particularly, and we found, was that we could get very little out of Premiership Rugby about what the situation was. You know, it was difficult, and of course there was a complete rebuttal by Saracens as well. So it was, as I say, it's what made it such a good piece of journalism, because it was a very tough nut to crack.
Well, I mean, what's your gut feeling about that report? Because I've spoke to people that have read the report. I spoke to quite a few now, and I seem to get the same answer from them all, which is the companies are just the tip of the iceberg. But I don't tend then to get anything more substantial. Just from your investigation...
Well, that's what I mean, because the companies have been... You know, the detail about that has been revealed. And yet there's a situation now where they can't... You know, they need to shave. And I'll be honest with you, I've not been huge... Since I got to the Times, I've not been hugely involved in this story because you know, we've got some very good rugby writers at the Times, and they've done some very good work on it, even though it was originally Laura's story.
Yeah.
People like Owen Slot and Alex Lowe have done some really good work on it. So, you know, I've contributed when I've been able to, but I've not contributed very much. You know, I tend to work on my own stuff. So,
yeah.
So, you know, at the end of the day, that's Laura's story. And, you know, she's now cracking on without the BBC. The rugby guys have got to do it because it's their thing, but it's playing out. But from what I understand, you know, that if they're 2 million over and they couldn't address that situation and make themselves compliant this season, then it's got to be beyond those arrangements, doesn't it? But well, of course, we don't know, do we? Because we're not being allowed to read the report.
Yeah, which, I mean, I think that's outrageous, actually. And also, just for the integrity of the game, that report has to come out now. I think it's untenable to keep it secret for much longer.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'd agree with you. And I suspect if it doesn't come out, a journalist will get it.
In terms of the salary cap report, then, do you think that there is any scope to say, look, they did all these companies, they've admitted to it, but actually when we look into it, they all look fairly commercial, and the reason that they're over the cap is basically the wording of the cap regulations rather than actually anything too nefarious.
But then why can't they make themselves compliant now?
Because if they were caught out previously, then those lump sums would have been averaged across all of the contracts. So you'd have to get rid of the contracts. So, you know, if you're over last year, you'd be over this year, and you'd be over next year until the new contracts are drawn.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, the thing about it is, and I have some sympathy for these clubs that get into these problems. You know, it's a bit like what we're seeing in football with FFP. You know, why... You know, there is a decent argument, for instance, for Manchester City, who are currently being investigated. When you've got that kind of wealth behind you, why should you be limited on how you spend your money?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't a situation that was in place when Manchester United were dominating. It wasn't a situation that was in place when Blackburn won the Premier League title.
Mm-hmm.
Ditto when Newcastle were challenging and John Hall was spending fortunes up at St James's Park. But now they've tried to bring it in. I understand why they did. I understand what Platini did, although look at Platini now. But the fact is, if people sign up for the rules, they are the rules.
Yeah.
And if you're cheating, if people are financially doping, then they're financially doping. So they have to take the consequences. And you know, it's tough. You know, don't sign up to it if you don't want to abide by it.
I think the role of journalism, and particularly in sport, is getting more and more difficult with the amount of barriers which are thrown in the way of reporters.
Yeah, look, you could say, certainly when I started as a, you know, on national papers back in the mid-90s as a sort of jobbing district football reporter, the sort of bread and butter of that role has now been undermined by media teams and websites and their own TV channels. So whereas you would have been the sort of conduit to fans for the manager's press conference or whatever, a Man United fan can now watch MUTV to watch that, then he's buying newspapers.
Yeah.
But then journalism, I think, has responded accordingly. And I just think it means that we just have to work harder and be more resourceful and more imaginative. And I don't think sports journalism has ever been better, because the fact of the matter is the Premier League have a media team.
Yes.
But that didn't stop me revealing that Richard Scudamore got a £5 million payoff.
Yes. Yes, yes,
PFA exactly. have a media team, but that didn't stop me finding out that there was an almighty war going on within the organisation, which is now leading to a serious charity commission investigation, and has actually ended with Gordon Taylor, agreeing that he's going to stand down. That stuff that the media teams do, player interviews, that's not what newspapers, that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's boring.
Yeah, and I guess it sort of goes into your point you made earlier on about the funding for investigative journalism and all the rest of it, which is, it's boring, and maybe this is the way that newspapers and, bigger media outlets tilt their coverage now.
And I think they are. And I think if you look at just the last year in newspapers, it's newspapers that I think, for the most part, as I say, there's some very good broadcast reporters out there. And I've mentioned Mark Davey and people like Dan Rowan at the BBC. Superb journalists. They get their own stories. Martha Kellner at Sky. Superb journalists. And I see them all as, they're friends on the road, but I see them also as rivals. Very much so. I have to keep an eye on what Dan Rowan is up to because he's an extremely good operator. And will, he actually did me on a story just before Christmas. I had a story, made the mistake of sitting on it for a few days, and that's one thing, that's one area where it has changed. You can't sit on anything anymore. Yeah. If you get a story, you just got to break it. Now that's the beauty of online, and I actually love a lot of traditional newspaper reporters aren't always massive fans of online. I love online because what online does is it what the newspaper websites do is they give you a global reach. The stuff goes everywhere. People are reading it on social media. You're not just relying on someone buying a newspaper in the newsagent to see your stuff. It just goes everywhere, and it goes, it goes global because it gets carried on the different social media platforms as well as on the websites itself. Mm. So it's brilliant, but that was a lesson, as I say. Dan, I had this story up my sleeve, and it was just before Christmas. I was walking out doing my Christmas shopping, and I was thinking, I've got that for later. That'd be a good way to sign off for Christmas. And then the office rang me and said, Dan Rowan's got that story.
Yeah.
I said, I can't believe it.
Not ideal.
But that's the, that's the nature of the business, and there's some very good journalists, but that's the way it's going. But I think, you look at the last year, you look at what the stories that newspapers have broken, Saracens being the best of the lot, but, The story about Rob Howley at the Rugby World Cup, that was a Daily Mail story.
Yeah, that's a fascinating one. I mean, how would you? I can't even begin to imagine how you would uncover that.
Well, I think the key with that was that the Mail actually had someone with Wales.
Really?
So it came out of Wales. It came out of the Wales squad, or the Wales, the camp.
Yeah.
But the Mail were the one national newspaper that had somebody there.
And what?
Now that comes down to my previous point about resources and money. They've spent the money, to have somebody with the Wales team, and that was their reward. Now, not forgetting the fact that Will Kelleher, who I work with, again, he was one of the original people that I worked with, when I was started working with some of the younger guys at the Mail. Yeah. He's a very bright young journalist, and he got a very good story.
Do you mind if I ask just a couple more questions just about the process of that sort of story? So you get the tip, you've got a guy in Wales. Do you then have to approach all of the betting companies asking, do you have this individual betting with you? How do you then uncover the rest of it?
I think you struggle to do that because having we did a story last year about a betting scandal story, and actually bookmakers can't really talk to you in that detail because I don't know. I've not spoken to it because I don't work with Will Keller. I'm at the Times now.
Yeah.
So I know Will because I did work with him. I don't know the ins and outs of it, but all I do know is that it's very hard to extract that kind of information from bookmakers because of data protection laws.
Yeah. So you basically got to find the story, report it to a regulator, and then wait for the outcome, essentially.
Didn't lots of people know the bets that were being placed? Didn't people know about...
To be honest...
You know, weren't there,
I mean,
players know, and wasn't it kind of WhatsApp groupy kind of... I don't know. I didn't go to the Rugby World Cup, so I don't really know the ins and outs of that one. All I was saying to you is another story broken by newspapers, story we did at the Times, you know, about that I did before Christmas about the chief executive of UK Athletics having to stand down before she'd even started her job because her husband was operating as a coach and as a team manager, when he, without the relevant checks in place, because he'd actually been banned from teaching for an inappropriate relationship with a 15-year-old girl.
Bloody hell.
You know, so again, that's what I'm talking about. You know, holding people to account. That's the chief executive of Britain's biggest Olympic sport. And, you know, she had to, you know, she was a week away from getting the job and she had to stand down.
Oof. It's not rugby related, but it is a story which you've covered and a fascinating one at that. Could you just go through with me a little bit about the match fixing scandal with the Sodgy brothers, which did with Ryan Kiesel?
With the what?
Which did with Ryan Kiesel for the Mail.
It was a long time ago, crikey. blimey.
It's just a really interesting story, and obviously it ended up in jail time and whatnot.
Yeah. God, blimey. I'd have to... I can barely remember what I wrote last week, never mind all those years ago. I'd have to... You know what? I'd have to go back and read up. I remember it was a fascinating story. And I remember how far the connection spread with some pretty prominent names. But yeah, it's...
Because I guess the reason it sticks out is because there's so many different aspects to it. There's the Damilola Taylor aspect to it. There's a charity commission. There's a national crime agency. And then when you sort of string all these things together, you think, wow, that's that kind of goes beyond sports reporting, really.
Well, yeah, it does. And at times it does. You know, for instance, you know, we a story we did, say, last year, which was about an alleged Ponzi scheme in Kent, a horse racing Ponzi scheme, and it affects, you know, nobody knew anything about it, and it's probably affected 4,000 or 5,000 people in Kent, and we're talking tens of millions of pounds involved. And when we first did it, and Laura was involved and Mike Keegan was involved, and when we first did it and we were started writing about this betting syndicate, the members of the betting syndicate who all thought their money had been turned into, they all thought water had been turned into wine, basically.
Yeah.
You know, people had invested £50,000 and it had turned into £200,000. And some people had their money out because, you know, the way Ponzi schemes work is that people do get paid out to build confidence. And it turns out the money's gone. And you've got people that have remortgaged their homes. And it's now... it's now a police investigation. You know, it's now being investigated by the police, and you know, in all likelihood, it's going to end up in court. And you know, those kind of stories, and you wouldn't expect a sports reporter to probably say to you, you know, there was a day when we knocked on the door. The guy behind it is a retired police officer, and there was a day when we had to go and knock on his front door. And put the allegations to it.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You know, Roger Cook style. People think sports journalists just sit in managers' press conferences and take down quotes and turn it into a story, which of course still happens. I still sit in those press conferences. You know, I went to David Moyes' first game at West Ham because he's someone that interests me, and I went to that game. But we also do stuff like the story I did with Ryan, on the match fixing that can take you into that world as well.
Well, I just wanted to pick up on that a little bit more because, you know, like you just said then, the idea of sports reporters, I know a fair few rugby writers who travel up and down to Sale Sharks, and yeah, they write the stories about the matches, fine. But then you don't necessarily sign up for all the other things which you've just explained. Do you ever get intimidated? Because you are dealing with very powerful people, and in some cases a lot of money too, and there's reasons why they might want to cover this up.
There is. I'm not saying yes, do I ever get intimidated? No, I don't. It can get quite unpleasant at times, but no, if you knew me, you'd know that kind of thing wouldn't worry me. The more aggressive people are towards me, the more determined I get to the bottom of it.
That can't be the makeup of every sports journalist, if you see what I mean. I mean, most of these guys get into it because they love rugby or football or something. But then to make that transition must be slightly different.
Yeah, I think there's still plenty of people that do. Yeah, some people I think would naturally shy away from what you're talking about here is confrontation. You know, just look at Dan Rowan in the car park the other day.
Yes.
With Ed Griffiths. You know, I remember Ed Griffiths as a press officer. I covered the 95 World Cup in South Africa. I remember him as this charming press officer. He perhaps needs to remember how to treat journalists who are doing their jobs. I thought Dan couldn't have been more polite in that car park. You know, I thought he was incredibly polite. But, you know, there is a degree of confrontation in being in the car park with a camera.
Mm.
I get that. But sometimes you have to do it. Sometimes you have to knock the door. Sometimes you have to put it to people, and that's the job. You know, I've been in near physical altercations with people over the years. You know, it can get pretty heated.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the outcome of some of these things is, you know, someone might lose an awful lot of ill-gotten gain or, you know, just a lot of money full stop. And I think that's probably where I'd think twice, because, you know, that's when it really matters to people. They don't really care if you say that they've had a bad game. But when it comes to money, obviously, you know, it gets a little bit fraught.
Yeah, but that's, you know, look, I guess a lot of it comes down to the fact that it's what interests me. You know, I'm interested in, you know, when someone tells me about some alleged wrongdoing, I'm interested, you know, I'm engaged. I still love sport, don't get me wrong, you know, and I think I've been accused occasionally of having a bit too much of a negative view of it. I love sport, you know. I went to Loughborough University as an aspiring middle-distance runner, and that's probably partly what motivates me to do as much as I do on things like athletics. You know, I've done quite a few doping stories in the last few years on athletics. Perhaps the most recent one being, you know, Christian Coleman, the world's fastest man, missing 3 drug tests. You know, but what motivates me about that is I do love the sport.
Yeah.
And I don't like it when I think people are being dishonest. So, you know, I won't flinch when it comes to confronting people about it. You know, if I think they might be guilty of something bad, then I'll go after them.
Do you ever think sports journalists get jaded by sport? I mean, this is always one of the things that I think, which is when you've seen so much of it for so long, you kind of forget or you don't realise how special the thing is that you're watching.
No, I don't. No, not at all. Because sport just throws up, has the ability to throw up something new all the time that just takes the breath away. You know, whether it's Tiger Woods, you know, winning another major or the Cricket World Cup final. Like, you're just there going, this is unbelievable. And only sport can do that. You know, I you know, people think I've written a lot of, you know, I've written quite a lot of hard stuff on cycling and British cycling. But I'll tell you something, that team pursuit in Rio 4 years ago, one of the best things I've ever seen. Yeah. You know, I was absolutely mesmerising 4 minutes of sport where, I don't know if you remember it, but the Australian, you know, the way it works on the scoreboard is that the team that's slightly up, their numbers are in green, and the teams that are slightly down are in red. The whole way, the Australians are in green, whole way. And then they've got like 600 metres to go. Suddenly it's switched as the British quartet suddenly hit the front. It's unbelievable sport. So yeah. I've done, I don't know, how many have I done? I've done six World Cups, maybe. But you know, this is what you come into it for. You know, I chose to be a sports journalist because I rather hoped I might be an athlete, but I wasn't good enough. But at sort of 15, 16, I remember realising from reading the paper that my dad brought home that people were actually getting paid to sit in the stadium. Whether I was reading about the Olympics or whatever, I think I was even younger. And what, someone actually gets paid to go?
Yeah.
Oh, wow, that'd be amazing, sitting there and being in the Olympic Stadium watching Cohen Ovet, which was sort of one of my first things that really caught my attention, you know, 1980 Olympics. To actually be there. What people paid to be in Moscow to be there. Oh, yeah. And they get to write about it. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was...
You don't lose that. I don't lose that. I felt after 20 years as a football reporter doing match, I felt I needed a change back in sort of 2011, 2012.
Yeah.
But I don't tire of sport at all, no.
And just on the stories that you put out, I mean, the cycling is a really good example. You know, obviously you've got a real passion for that event. But on the other hand, you've been involved with making the sport, well, not making the sport, they did that themselves, but you've been responsible for exposing some of the nastier elements of the sport too. Do you ever feel when you're in the middle of a big story that, okay, this needs to be exposed, but actually the long-term damage to this sport doesn't really represent what's good about it? There's almost like too much of an emphasis on the negative side.
Question to answer. You sometimes can be conscious of the potential collateral damage. You know, for instance, you know, British cycling going through this Richard Freeman thing at the moment, and it could ultimately be something that slightly tarnishes the reputation of everyone that's competed for the British team in the last few years. And
yeah.
I certainly don't look at people like, you know, Laura Kenny and see anything other than an outstanding young bike rider who's also rather charming and just a delight to write about. And again, passion for sport. You know, I ride my bike with my local cycling club every Saturday morning. You know, I love cycling. I love covering the Tour de France. It's in many ways, it's what I love about it is the purity of it as a form of sports writing because you're writing about live action every day, which you don't get at things like World Cup.
Yeah.
You know, because you've got those days between matches when you've just got to find other things to write about. The beauty of the tour is not only you get to drive around this beautiful country, for 3 weeks, and you know, you're in the mountains and, you know, wonderful scenery. And it's such a colourful event to cover, you know, with the crowds and the, just the racing. But it is just being able to just write about a stage every day. But I'm afraid you can't just... Some people do, you know, some people do choose to... Some reporters do just choose to focus only on that, only on how well somebody rode their bike up a hill. I can't do that. I just can't do that. I can't leave it at that. If there's suggestion of wrongdoing, and look, while I think you have to draw a bit of a line under the past with things like cycling, I don't think there's much point in going back. But I do think there's a responsibility to pursue these stories if you're made aware of them. Yeah, it's very rare that you go looking for them and find them. They always come to you.
Yeah.
Because that's just the way it happens. It's a bit like Zara High Peters at UK Athletics. I didn't know even know the name of her husband. But when somebody rings you and they say there's a safeguarding issue with the new chief executive, and then you go and meet somebody who happens to be a recently retired detective chief inspector of the police, and he was the chairman of the club that this has happened at, and he's actually got a file of evidence.
Jeez.
Now, that might destabilise UK Athletics, little more than 6 months out from the Olympic Games. What am I going to do? Am I going to walk away from that and just ignore it? Or am I going to do the story?
It's a good question. I mean, I think I know the answer to that one. Can you ever see a scenario, or be in a scenario, where you have not reported, basically for the good of the sport? Or is this just straight down the line?
What, have I ever just not done a story?
Yeah, as in, is it, you know, maybe...
Because
maybe the damage might be so severe, or maybe the story doesn't warrant the damage, or something along those lines.
Yeah. I've certainly done it on one occasion.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I've done it on a couple of occasions. One involved, let's just say, the chief executive of a sports team.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even want to say which sport, but the problem was it would have had repercussions for one of their kids.
I see.
And basically, it involved the chief executive falsifying the age of their child, so that they could play with younger people at the team.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't run the story because I didn't want to have to deal with that kid going into school.
Yeah.
The next day. Well, I've got four kids of my own.
Yeah.
So I thought it was the most, it was, of all the things I was sort of probing the chief executive on, that was by far the, for me, ethically, the biggest issue I had. And I've never run that story because there's a kid involved.
Fascinating.
And I blame the parent.
Yeah.
And that's appalling parenting. And I couldn't have it on my conscience, that kid going to school and being vilified by classmates for something that I don't blame them for.
That's really interesting.
They're too young to know better. And another story I didn't do recently, but it was much more of a collective, was looking at another potential sort of safeguarding issue in sport. But there was a child involved, and sometimes the consequences for the child would have been more serious, more of a worry than the story. But the person does know that I was asking questions, and they know that I know.
A situation like that, because, you know, what has come out fairly strongly in this podcast is, if there's wrongdoing, you'd quite like to get to the bottom of it. Would you leave that situation with, okay, we're not going to report this, but kind of adjust your behaviours, or is it, I'm just not going to run this, do what you like?
Well, the first one I mentioned, I've never actually mentioned it to the person.
Okay. Oh, really? Wow.
No, they don't know that I know, but I do. Uh-huh. It's just, to be honest, it's just too embarrassing. Too embarrassing that someone's done that, that a parent has done that. I say I've got four kids.
Yeah.
I would not tell one of my kids, look, I'm gonna lie about your age. Yeah, you should be in the under 13s, but I'm gonna say you're 12.
Surely the kid then
you'll be bigger. Well, the kid will know.
The kid knows. I mean, it's so stupid.
Yeah, but if your dad's telling you to do it, then you somehow, in that kind of skewed reasoning, you're going to think it. You might think it's right. So, no, that's the one. That's probably the second one I mentioned. Yeah, it was a non-starter, really.
Yeah,
for legal reasons. Yeah, it wasn't my decision. It would be wrong to say it was my decision. That was just a non-starter. But no, that's probably the one that I've not acted on, because I was horrified by it, purely as a more from a parenting perspective than a journalistic perspective. I was just like, oh my god, you know, what on earth have you done that for? Sorry, I remember you told a story about Lance Armstrong where his mum used to lie about him being older than he was so he could race against the older kids. I remember someone saying how that was appalling parenting. I didn't have such an issue with that.
Yeah, not really.
But the other way around is a terrible example to set to your kids.
Isn't it just? Do you know, just tangentially, I do think one of the scandals which will be coming down the road sometime soon will be, well, certainly in rugby, how they are going to deal with young kids coming through the system. Because the money's not there at the moment. But as the salary cap bites and whatnot, I mean, they've just got to... I mean, basically, the transfer market is going to be kids, because that's the only time when they're not regulated or have England credits or whatnot. And I can see it going the same way as football. I'm sure football has got its act together in terms of how they manage these vast swathes of kids. But I was talking to someone from Manchester United the other day, and they tried out something like 50-odd goalkeepers for the under-8s or something ridiculous. Or under 13s, or whatever it is.
I don't think football has got it right with kids. I think it's all gone bonkers with kids. You know, I was when you got 9-year-olds, being taken by Man City as they were at one point. Man City were when a 9-year-old signed a contract. That's the youngest that you can sign a contract in.
Nine years old.
And they're putting them in with their parents into Hummer limousines to take them to the Etihad campus to sign a contract.
It's outrageous. I mean, it's
a bit nutty, and it's for a kid, a 9-year-old being in a limousine, you know, because they're going to sign a contract, it's just all a bit obscene. And I think, to be fair to City, I think they've kind of checked that a bit. I think it's all calmed down a bit, but because battles are being fought over kids of that age, you know, clubs are scouting systems, academies, because obviously you can not only make a lot of money if you get a kid young enough, you can save a lot of money, you know, and if you get the right kids, you know, they can be worth a fortune. But it's all a bit bonkers. My biggest concern in rugby with youngsters is the abuse of performance-enhancing drugs.
Yes.
You know, I think that's the real worry with teenage rugby players.
Oh, it's probably...
You you only got to look at the UCAD sanctions to see that it's becoming increasingly common. And you can just see the pressure to make that transition from being an adolescent to a man mountain, if you like. I remember looking at it a few years ago, potential doping concerns in rugby. The most staggering statistic I remember was that the England under 19 team, pound for pound, was heavier than the 91 Rugby World Cup final Will Carling team.
Yeah. So were they not heavier than
9-year-old?
I think they were heavier than the World Cup winning team from the Morton Johnson had in the pack, and that's like a couple of years ago.
I don't remember that. I do remember they were heavier than Brian Moore, Jeff Probyn, Wade Dooley, Paul Ashworth, Dean Richards. I don't remember that scrum. Who was it? Mike Teague. It was Winterbottom was open side, wasn't it? Who was the other prop? Probyn, Moore. Who was the other prop?
It'd be before Leonard. So
it was Jason Leonard.
Oh,
Jason Leonard.
Was it?
It was. Yeah, it was a very young Jason Leonard. Yeah. So yeah. Forget me. RFU president's name. Amazing that a bunch of teenagers can be heavier than those lads. And I know they weren't full time. Like my first job in journalism was as a rugby correspondent down at the Western Daily Press in Bristol. And I remember interviewing John Callaghan after he kicked the winning goal at Murrayfield to beat Scotland, and he was, I interviewed him at school on the Monday. We had school dinners together because he was a school teacher, and he trained Tuesdays and Thursdays. And I remember doing a piece once with Jeremy Guskett on Field of Glanville where, they were having to go down the track at first thing in the morning to do a bit of extra training because Bath training was Tuesdays and Thursday nights. So I totally get that they've professionalized and, they're training more and supplements and diet and everything has massively progressed. Nigel Redmond would, when he was playing for Bath as a locker, was playing for England, he was an electrician. He spent all bloody day on his hands and knees,
Yeah.
And then he was playing for Bath on a Saturday, it's very different sport now. But so, my point is that was the environment of the 91 team. There's guys that worked in the city and, Acton was a policeman and, he was actually a school teacher at one point. He was actually taught at my school.
I do wonder, if rugby is fighting a losing battle against performance-enhancing drugs. Don't think there's a scandal in the professional game. I think it's very well regulated. Although there might be, who knows. I do think there's some questions to be answered about the younger lads coming through. But actually, the bigger question is, I think there's a very casual attitude now towards all sorts of performance-enhancing drugs right at the lowest level. I mean, I've seen it. And from a guy who plays at lower level every week still, you look at some of the teams showing up at second team, some of the body shapes at second team, you think, that's not natural. And I think we're losing the battle because it's no longer a rarity. You don't need to go to a scientist or whatnot. You can get them almost anywhere. Everyone's at CrossFit, everyone does supplements, everyone's into this stuff now.
Well, UK Anti-Doping issued a report last week. I went to the press conference on Friday, which was about, the abuse, the widespread abuse. I think it was a piece in The Guardian that said over a million, at least a million users of, they call them iPads now, image and performance enhancing drugs.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
So because they think one of the big motivations, particularly among young men, is body image.
Definitely.
Looking ripped on the beach and looking ripped when they post their own pictures on social media, and there's massive abuse of it, and but I also suspect in rugby, in sports like rugby, that there is pressure to, as I say, to bulk up and to if you're going to make it, because it's the senior guys are massive, and I still have my worries about the professional game. I did a story a couple of years ago where I think some of the Premiership clubs had gone an entire season without receiving a unannounced test. What's the phrase? Where they've turned up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, the randomised tests.
Out of competition test.
Yeah.
So how can that be right? You know, and that comes down to resource, and that comes down to the RFU finances not having sufficient resource to pay, because you know, at the end of the day, you have to pay.
I think
you have to pay UCAD to have those tests.
I think I know what your answer would be to this, but I mean, could you or would you be more comfortable if we just had a different standard for sports, say like the NFL, where it's illegal, but we all know it's not really that illegal.
Sorry, how do you mean?
So in the NFL, they have a drugs testing policy, which is widely known to be more of an IQ test than an actual drugs test. And I do wonder if some of the smaller sports, bearing in mind, you know, when you watch some of the documentaries about drugs testing and how much it costs and how complex it can be and so on and so forth, I kind of think maybe we just throw in the towel and say, well, there's a different standard now, and we'll do these IQ tests and that will be that, and we'll enjoy a great product.
Because testing has to become more stringent and more widespread, because at the end of the day, you know, as that report said on Friday, people die if they abuse this stuff, right? You know, the side effects, you know, they're talking about in that report about there being like an NHS time bomb, because what will happen is there will be a higher incidence of kidney problems, heart problems, liver problems, cancers, because this stuff is bad for you. You know, never mind the like, I actually said to them on Friday, you know, the thing you should target, if you want to really rattle young men who are using this stuff, and I know this is the case because I've known people that have used it. You know, I know people that have done steroids, you know, who just, you know, for their own, for the looking good thing.
Just for the aesthetic.
Sports people. Yeah, yeah. And one of the side effects, massive side effect, erectile dysfunction. So, you know, you get people who, you know, they're having to use Viagra, you know, substances like Viagra to combat the side effects of the performance enhancing drugs.
Yeah, it's a tricky one, because actually, you know, I think one of the biggest problems with it, and one of the biggest dangers, is when you do it, you have to do it so underhand. You have no idea what you're taking, what the standards are, what the dosage should be, you know, information.
Yeah, that's true. It is all very much, you know, yeah, literally people watching YouTube videos to learn how to take it or inject it or whatever. No, it's terrifying. Absolutely terrifying, this grey market, as they call it, because one of the problems is that while it is illegal to traffic it and to import it, it's not illegal to possess or use. So you know, it's class, they're class C drugs, but you can't just open the floodgates to say, look, everyone just crack on with it, because people will die.
Yeah.
And it would just be horrific. And it's not just the physical impact of it. There are psychological issues, there are mental issues that it can cause. Everyone knows what roid rage is. But that isn't just a loose phrase. Yeah. That is real. It makes people aggressive. It could be a contributing factor in domestic violence. You know, these are not drugs that we should just open the doors to.
I get that.
And what actually... Go on.
I get that. The analogy that I use, and bear with me, Matt, because it is ridiculous. But the analogy that I use is, a few weeks ago, I decided I'm going to smoke a cigar. Bearing in mind that I've never smoked anything in my life ever, I thought, that looks cool, I'll go out and buy one. Before I did, I went on the internet and researched cigars. Are they worse? Are they better? You know, what is the situation? And everything that I read about cigars and smoking was, one cigarette is just as bad as 10, and then 10 is just as bad as 100. And the answer is, no, just don't do it. I thought, this is nonsense. I know I can have a cigar and live a full and happy life afterwards. And I think that's where we are with drugs, which is, so performance enhancers, which is, you know, If we sort of threw in the towel on the enforcement, or we enforced it differently, we could probably get safer outcomes rather than the time bomb that you refer to. Because, like you say, they're looking on YouTube, and I'm not saying we should take it. We should be trivial about it.
Yeah.
But we need a different way to look at it, I think.
No, we just we just need more investment in it. It's a joke how little we spend on it.
Mm.
It's a joke how little is spent generally on it. It's a massive issue. It's a massive problem, and yet, you know, there is obscene amounts of money swirling around in sport. And yes, the smaller sports might not be able to afford it. Yes, you couldn't turn to English netball and say, right, you've got to put in the same as the RFU. Of course not. But there needs to be a form of taxation.
Yes.
That corresponds to the revenue in each sport. So the Premier League, even though I don't think there is a massive doping issue in the Premier League, if we want to protect the integrity of sport, the Premier League should be paying tens of millions towards doping. Right now, the UK anti-doping operates on a budget. I think they got it. Certainly 2 years ago, it was about $3 million a year.
Yeah.
Right? You get into a couple of legal battles with a couple of boxers, you start to burn through that cash quite rapidly.
Yeah.
So it is a nonsense. There need to be more powers. There need to be more investigative powers. You know, I remember when we did the stuff about British cycling and about, you know, concerns over medical records and stuff at British cycling. UK anti-doping had to alert British cycling to the fact they were coming.
Really?
You know? Well, you know, because I annoyed a few people by using the word raid, because it wasn't a raid. But I did not realise that when UK anti-doping testers turned up, or investigators, I should say, turned up at the National Cycling Centre in Manchester, it didn't occur to me for one second that they phoned ahead.
No, it wouldn't occur to me either. Why would you do that?
And that's because legally they can't just turn up and say, right, we're locking down your medical facility, we're having your computers. They can't do it. Not allowed to.
Interesting. Matt,
So
I've just got to say this. I've actually got lost in time here. I've got so carried away with this. I've forgotten that I've got a school pickup in 10 minutes.
No
so massive,
yeah,
massive, massive,
on a bit, haven't we?
Massive, massive yeah. Apologies. There is one more thing that I'd like to ask you though. When it's all said and done, and you're looking on your office wall, I assume you've got an office study where you do some typing and whatnot.
What will be the up as a laundry? But yeah,
yeah, yeah, mine too.
Yeah.
What story will you have framed and then mounted on your wall?
Oh, blimey! Oh, I don't know. Pass.
Oh,
pass.
Never mind.
No. I'm very proud to work for the Times. I like what I do. You know, I'm 50 this year. I hope I've got a few more years in me yet. I love what I do. I love it. But I am always looking at the next one. I don't really look back. I just it's always about the next one.
Fantastic. We're gonna have to pick this up again another time. But in the meantime, where can we find you? If at all on social media, and where can you follow
Twitter,
all your stuff?
Lawton _ Times, I think it is. and in the Times, and please subscribe to the Times. I think it's good value for money. It's a great product. So, and I say I'm very proud to be working there.
Thank you so much. I did tell you it'd be 30 minutes, and we're on 1 hour and 10 now, and I feel that we could have gone for an hour and 40. So thanks a lot, Matt. Yeah. I really do appreciate it.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.